Fanning. Weekends on 2FM.
Stuart, how you doing? Are you all right?
I'm good, Dave. How are you?
I'm very good indeed. My God, you sound like you're in the bottom of a well. Hold on, I'm just going to turn you up there. Okay, Stuart Clark is here, I'm delighted to say, because there's two things here. First of all, today marks the fourth anniversary of the death of Dolores O'Riordan, and Hot Press, as in Stuart, has brought out this incredible thing, which is basically kind of a celebration of the Cranberries and a celebration. I'll give you the actual title. It's called Why Can't We? The Story of the Cranberries and the Band's Iconic Frontwoman Dolores O'Riordan, curated by Stuart Clark, as told through the pages of Hot Press. So let's take a look at that straight away, what that is, because it's a very dramatic and inspiring way to tell a story, as Niall Stokes says around the very beginning. But like, basically, it's, you know, it's doable from your point of view. You have the material. You were there from day one till the very end, weren't you?
For once in my life, Dave, I was in the right place at the right time. I was a Cub DJ and reporter in Limerick in 1989, when four very hairy guys started a band called the Cranberry Saurus. They were nearly called the Cranberry Doodles. It could have been worse. And then the hairiest one, Niall Quinn, after about sort of 10 gigs, decided to leave. And I thought, as these things you usually work out, that'd be the end of the band. But my then girlfriend was at Laurel Hill School in Limerick and said, one of the girls in my year is going to try out for those guys, you know. And I said, well, who is she? And, oh, it's a girl called Dolores. I said, is she any good? She went, well, she does a decent Ave Maria in the school choir, but I don't think she's ever been to a rock gig. So again, I thought that was it, but history showed us otherwise.
Do you know, it's all fun and games till someone loses an eye, etc., the Hitchers and all that. Was Niall a member of the Hitchers or not?
Do you know what it was? Niall had Ringo Starr syndrome. He was the drummer in the Hitchers, but wrote songs.
Right.
And they wouldn't let the drummer sing. So he said, OK, I'm starting another band as well as staying with the Hitchers. But then the Hitchers were taking off faster than the Cranberry Saurus.
Yeah.
So back to the day job. In fact, he sort of helped find the replacement singer, who was Dolores. But I think most of us, even the band, when she turned up wearing a pink tracksuit for her audition with a Casio keyboard under her arm, apparently she sort of, you know, plugged in, went plink, plink, plink. And they were looking at each other going, oh, my God, we're wasting our time.
Yeah.
Then she took a breath and sang Nothing Compares to You, and their jaws just hit the floor.
Okay, well, the band, like, obviously developed, became extremely successful, etc. They grew in confidence. Dolores had something to say all the time, and we all know the story there. And so, but let's just stay back in those early days where you were in Limerick with the Cranberries. You wrote their first press release, and I presume they were the Cranberries Saw Us at that time, were they?
They were still the Saurus.
Even when I say it, what a terrible name.
I suppose Led Zeppelin. You just kind of get used to it.
Yeah.
It could have been the Cranberry Doodles. But they paid me now with a bottle of Jack Daniels, which is singularly the best afternoon's work I've ever done.
What, drinking it?
Drinking it and receiving it. It lasted more than the afternoon, a couple of days.
Right, okay, fair enough. Now, the book that you brought out, which really is like massively impressive, it's just called Why Can't We? And it is a celebration of Dolores and the Cranberries as well, and some fabulous stuff from Emer O'Connor as the art director, etc. Well, we're talking here about a band who went on to sell, you know, 40 million albums plus a billion views on YouTube for one of their songs, Zombie, etc. And then, of course, you mentioned the deep and enduring sadness at the heart of the whole thing. But let's take a look at just a couple of things. November 1889, you have the Flag Cafe on Limerick's Broad Street. Is that correct? Now, were you at that gig by any chance?
I wasn't at that one. Only about 30 people were. And Noel says that apparently they thought that was the end of their career. That was without Dolores, and it was so bad.
Yeah, he's been so honest about it, hasn't he? He said it was appalling.
They've always been unvarnished. I mean, if Dolores got sent to media training, she failed the course because she would speak her mind. You know, Dave, nowadays people are very careful about what they say in the internet age. But basically, Dolores had her beliefs and she told you them in a forthright fashion. But she'd also have a conversation with you. She loves sort of arguing over things, discussing things. But yeah, they thought they were stillborn. That first gig was so horrendous.
Do you know, I'm just looking here at one of the things you have in the book too, which is brilliant in terms of just, you know, the actuality of it, because I haven't seen this since it happened, which is the, what do you call it, the actual poster for the gig Cork Rocks. And what can you remember? I mean, like Cork Rock 91 by this stage, right? And I mean, we had three nights there, and then we had the Lark in the Park on the Monday after that. But I mean, some of the stuff and the bands that are there, like the Cranberries were stuffed away in the middle of the Saturday afternoon or the Saturday evening, and they didn't play Friday or Sunday. And some of the bands that are there, like some of them went on to be big names like Therapy and all the rest of it. But I mean, the Cranberries were just, you know, they were just a band. That's all they were. Like, and they break up by Christmas like all the other bands.
But I remember, Dave, when we heard they were doing Cork Rocks, we were going, oh my God. Because the expectations, unfortunately, for Limerick bands weren't very high. The previous person who'd been on Top of the Pops,
Terry Wogan, you make it.
Doing the floral dance. And, you know, there'd been that full start with Tuesday Blue, who were on U2's mother label, got a massive big deal. Great band. Fantastic. Should have been stadium big, but it didn't happen. And Limerick people just thought, you know, it's not going to happen for our city. You know, you might support somebody in Dublin. You might get across to London. You might even release an EP or something.
Yeah.
The idea you go to the States and end up on the cover of Rolling Stone and all that kind of palaver, it just wasn't in the Limerick psyche back then.
Just looking at the lineup here on the Friday, May 31st, this is 91, the Precious Stones, Bird, the Subs, the Frank and Walters and the IRS. Well, the Frank and Walters, had they got their hit singles out at that stage?
I think they were just about in the process, you know, right. Cork, Chester was happening.
Yeah.
So to be involved, to go to Cork where there were A&R people, and that's when it sort of started generating a buzz, I think, in the A&R world. I mean, I happened to be by chance on the plane coming over from Heathrow when they played their famous gig in the Jetland in Limerick, and every single person on there was on a jolly from a record company. There was a stampede in a way you don't get anymore. So it did generate quite quickly because what happened was
I'm just thinking of the door being opened, certainly by the end of the 80s, it most certainly was, in terms of U2's success. And the A&R types were all coming over, were they?
They're coming over to Dublin, maybe to Cork, but Limerick was a tough ask. Yeah. I mean, the first third of the book is a love letter to Limerick from myself, the band. And Kevin Barry, the novelist, who was right there in the thick of things too, contributes a beautiful piece about Limerick. I had pitched up there. It had been called Stab City, all this negativity. I found it to be a wonderful place, great creativity. And in a way, there's a certain kind of a thing about it wasn't connected with Dublin. People weren't slavishly trying to be hip. They were being themselves. And eventually that paid off with the Cranberries, with Kevin and Virtue, you know, lots of other people.
Yeah. I think it's Kevin who says the brilliant thing. He just sums it up in one bit where he talks about you stick the cigarette into the electric fire to light it kind of thing, or the bar, the electric fire. It's brilliant. Anyway, it is a big love letter to Limerick in all the first third, all right, no question about that. But just like when I say like Cork Rocks 91, I mean, they did have songs like Linger and Dreams by that stage, didn't they?
It's incredible, Dave, that the first song Dolores ever wrote was Linger, based on some chords, you know, Noel gave her. I think about the second song was Dreams. But what happened was I'd seen him for the first time in, I think, about the April, May of, I suppose, 89, or was it 90? And they weren't great. To be honest with you, Dolores was very, very nervous. She was looking at the floor, the ceiling, the drum kit, anybody but the crowd. And her voice was going in and out of tune. I could see there's something there, but I'll be honest, I didn't realise what. There was a guy called Pierce Gilmore, had a studio called Zerik.
Yeah.
Now, they'd just done their leaving certs, I think, when he said, look, I'll pay your pocket money wage for the summer. You'll record in the morning, rehearse and write in the afternoon or whatever, and we'll see where it goes. And myself and Kevin and another guy got a phone call in September, the promise of more free whiskey, to go to a little showcase gig in Zerik. She came out, transformed, she looked really kind of rock and roll. It was like Comisatatu, boom, Linger, boom, Dreams, and half the debut album. And that's when the hairs on the back of my neck stood up, and I just knew.
There's a review there of Cork Rocks 91 that you have in there from Colm O'Callaghan, and it really encapsulates it all right. So, by the way, just as a matter of interest, whatever happened to Hector Pickaxe and the Floating Crowbars?
This is the big question. Any day now, they're playing the long game.
All right, okay. I mean, like, you have a quote here, and like, you know, as honest as Dolores always was from the word go, I never went to a gig or even had heard of the term gig before I joined the band. I mean, she'd heard of the word rock concert, and she had never been to one, but you know, she'd been to a pub maybe, or something, but she'd never been to, like, the innocence of it all. And even when they suddenly got interviewed on Melody Maker and all that, again, she said some things that shocked people, actually. Like, I'd never seen a black person. That's just the way it is. That's just what our life was, isn't it?
she came from County Limerick. You know, she was very, very smart. But by the same token, in rock and roll terms, she was quite naive. She'd not been to gigs. She didn't really understand the mechanics. Now, she did have, like, the Smiths on her bedroom wall. She had been, you know, playing in the school choir and singing to a very high standard. But no, she didn't know much about rock and roll. And she did say things that the Melody Maker found rather sort of, you know, sort of quaint and Irish. But she was a very smart girl. She learned really fast. She was very, very wise. She had a gang of elder brothers, so she was well used to dealing with errant men, whether they be band members or journalists. And I'm sure you had the O'Riordan finger waved at you once or twice when she'd basically go, that's enough, Dave, that's enough, Stuart.
No, not necessarily. I'll tell you one thing when she wagged a finger, all right. When she did the first session in here and she has to go down from Studio 8 all down this very long corridor of RT to the studio where we were, which is where we are now, actually. And she insisted she wouldn't walk down unless she got a piggyback from Ian Wilson, who was producing the session. So she got the piggyback and was plonked down in front of us. Anyway, what was I going to say? Yeah, this thing with the support like of the in America and that, like, if you think about it, they broke the US before the UK. We know that. Now, here's the question, Stuart. Did they break the US before Ireland?
Absolutely. Yeah. Mm. And I think there was a little bit of resentment in some media circles that
people had missed out.
Oh, absolutely. How dare you go to America and be a hit band out of opposition? And certainly the British Inkies, the NME and Sounds and Melody Maker, they hated it. And they really put the boot in quite viciously. But sort of famously, the Cranberries were supporting Suede. The Cranberries took off. And what was happening is people were turning up, watching the Cranberries and going home, much to Brett Anderson's consternation. So in the end, you know, sort of the Cranberries had to go on last.
They took over that. That was a really big change around, all right. But also, if you think about it, you mentioned there the Smiths, that you had posters. I mean, Stephen Street became became the producer and all the right. Sorry?
He was there, George Martin. He was there, yeah. George Martin. Yeah.
But also, like, she said something along, you have it in the book, where it says, you know, I was frothing at the mouth when I suddenly realised this is the guy who made Every Day Is Like Sunday and Girlfriend in a Coma, etc. So she liked her music. There was no question about that. But she was always a nice person, wasn't she? She was always good and always honest and wagging the finger, maybe, but she knew what she was doing.
Well, the wagging of the finger was accompanied by a glint in the eye.
Yeah, exactly.
She was very loyal, you know, a bit like you two with you and their new tracks. She remembered people like us because we were there in the early days. And when they weren't doing any press, they would do hot press. And she invited me very touchingly down to her home once for an interview. And I met the kids and was given the freedom of the house to look around.
Fabulous picture as well in the book of her sitting at the piano.
But Dave, I've got to tell you, if I had that kind of money, I would do what they did. And you walked into the house in Kilmallock, right, after going down a massive long, you know, driveway, tended by old fellas, you know, minding her herbaceous border. Inside the front door, there was a stained glass window, the lyrics to Zombie. Absolutely brilliant. And then you went into the Wild West room, where they had all this imported bourbon and a lovely big wooden sort of bar. And they had stalls. And instead of seats, they were saddles. And you looked out the window and there was a massive Italian pizza oven that had been flown in from Rome and a load of Harley Davidsons. It was fantastic.
There's just a few other bits and pieces in terms of pictures. By the way, we're talking to Stuart Clark, and what we're looking at here is this now out released for the anniversary or any time, or is it coinciding with, or is it buyable in the shops as I talk, Stuart, by the way?
It's available in Dublin from Dubray, from Omani's in Limerick, and the Modern Way on hotpress.com shop. We knew the anniversary was coming up, but it was really a case of what we did during lockdown. The first day, myself and Niall Stokes were going, oh my goodness, there's no gigs, people are cancelling album releases, what are we going to do? And this idea has been percolating. And then, of course, we spoke to her brother, PJ, who's the manager, and he said, we'd love to be involved in something like this. The band came on board and it sort of took off from
there. Yeah, and of course, it's not just Dolores, there's all cranberries, of course, right across the book as well. Why Can't We is what it's called, the story of the cranberries and the band's iconic frontwoman, Dolores O'Riordan, curated by Stuart Clark, who we're talking to now, as told through the pages of Hot Press. So let's take a look at a few other bits here, because, you know, it's all the early bits that are just so interesting to so many of us. But it is, you know, the touring years. The touring years were huge. They took over in some ways, and they really did take their toll, and the insights are in this book, aren't they?
I think you see that all too familiar arc, Dave, that, you know, first of all, Kid in the Sweet Shop, you know, you've had Simon Le Bon on your wall, and then you're standing in front of him because you're supporting Duran Duran. Michael Stipe turns up at your first video shoot and invites you out on tour. You play with the Rolling Stones and the San Siro, and who wouldn't be blown away with that? But then as you get bigger, you know, your first album sells 8 million, the second one's got to sell 20 million, the third one's got to sell 30 or 40. And you get given a piece of paper telling you what the next 18 months of your life is.
Suddenly
you're... Sorry, Dave, yeah?
No, go on. I was just going to say, by the time of To the Faithful Departed, was there a backlash?
I think there was. I mean, in the UK, they just didn't like the fact that, say, they went off to the States. And I think, you know, Dolores admitted that, I think her genius, she never claimed to be Bob Dylan, was the fact she could take very complex human emotions and express them quite simply, that you related to them and you inserted yourself into the song. As Simon Le Bon said to us, "I'm just a fool for you." We've all been a fool for somebody, so you relate to that. She was a genius writing about emotions, the flutter of the heart, the first, you know, sort of signs of love, you know, a broken heart sometimes. But when she was trapped in the hotel room, because she's one of the most famous women in America, as you know, high profile as Madonna, she described one or two of the albums as her CNN albums, because she couldn't leave the hotel room. She went back after a gig, and she put on CNN and was watching Bosnia, you know, and of course was horrified. She wrote a song about that. And what Stephen Street tried to do towards the end, and those last two Cranberries albums are great, was get her to write about the personal again. And that's, I think, where her strength was.
I mean, like, she does say, just to encapsulate that at one stage, the psychic pig, I presume that's how it's pronounced because it's spelled that way, it's a place in Throwbridge, which is quite near Bristol or Bath or something like that. So he says that, "I went from the psychic pig in Throwbridge to Radio City Music Hall in New York City in the space of about 12 months. It was pure craziness." And they were constantly expected to be on the road, and were on the road as well. And as I say, took its toll. There was always an Irishness about Dolores and about the band, and a sense of where she came from all the time, wasn't it? I mean, like, well, we had a thing recently, we did a thing in the programme about people singing in their own accents. She was top of the bill. She sang in a Limerick accent, didn't she?
The further she roamed from home, the more Limerick she got. And it was almost, you know, she wanted to do that. She didn't want to become mid-Atlantic. And again, Stephen Street said, you know, he didn't have to encourage that. She wanted a sound. And, you know, Tuesday Blue actually were asked to try and sort of, you know, de-Limerick themselves by the record company. But I think Ireland knew what they'd got, that the charm lay from the fact they came from Limerick. They didn't sound like every American band or every English band. They had that USP. It's interesting because Stephen also said that it was all down to the four of them. It's easy to sort of, you know, just focus on Dolores. But he makes the point, Blur with four Damon Albarns would be terrible. It wouldn't work. And, like, you know, without Fergal, they wouldn't have been the Cranberries. Without Mike, they wouldn't have been the Cranberries. And certainly without Noel, with that songwriting collaboration. So it really was those component parts combined.
And some of the people you mentioned from Simon Le Bon, in fact, Michael Stipe is in the book and talking about it. It's a great picture of Ferg and Mike and Dolores at the Dewey Hotel. When was that? That was, is that in Los Angeles? Was that around, is that when they were making the video you were saying, no?
That was a flop house in Los Angeles. They just got a phone call saying, "Get over here quick." They were touring in Europe with the Hot House Flowers, fully expecting to be dropped because the album came out and for a year or so it didn't sell. Stephen Street was getting, you know, real grief off the record company. "You've messed it up, Stephen." And they saw it as a last unpaid holiday because they're relying on the Flowers for beer and food. So they find themselves in LA in this flop house with Melody doing the film noir video for Linger. And she actually says, apparently, you know, in the book, but she said it was like, I just mentioned to them that Michael was dropping in. And the band thought, "Oh, Michael, you know, friend of Melody's, be nice to meet him," not realizing it was Michael Stipe. And the next thing, you know, he walks in and hello. But he was sort of saying that they were just quite unlike anybody else. They were so up for it, so enthusiastic, no cynicism. He says Dolores was very striking, not just her looks, but just this sort of homespun philosophy. She was young but wise. He said he was really quite beguiled by her. He decided there and then he was going to take the Cranberries out on tour with REM, which he did a year or two later.
And you also, just finally, you have the solo albums, you go through all that as well, and all the periphery people involved, and D.A.R.K., Andy Rourke, and that. I don't know any of that music. Is it good?
Very good. Yeah, more dancey. And it was lovely to think she was a Smiths obsessive.
Yeah.
And she ended up in the band and best mates with Andy, who spoke to us. And it's really touching what both he and Dolores' boyfriend, Ollie Koretzky, have to say about her final years in New York.
Yeah.
You know yourself, New York is no great respecter of celebrity. So she had her life back. She was going to the grocery store, to the pizzeria, popping out for a drink, and really enjoying that freedom. Very creative again. Noel said he just couldn't keep up with the ideas she kept on throwing at him. And that last record is a perfect bookend to the first one. It's her back writing about stuff that had happened to her personally. I think it wasn't just, you know, a nod to her dying that they gave her a Grammy nomination. That record deserved it.
Okay, well, listen, Stuart, it's been a pleasure to read it and a pleasure to talk to you on the programme today. And of course, it was 4 years ago today that most people, I was certainly at the concert hall in Dublin, everybody from Nick Cave to Johnny Depp, etc., all there. And then like the news was coming through. Curated by Stuart Clark, it says, "Why can't we? The story of the Cranberries and their iconic frontwoman Dolores O'Riordan is told through the pages of Hot Press." And there's loads and loads of stuff in it. It's really brilliantly done. Well done. So listen, well done, Stuart. Thanks a million for talking to us. And I'll play this track here from the very end of the Cranberries, which is In the End.
Dave Fanning, Weekends on 2FM.